This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's not in the room. I'm Jenna Osman, and I teach at Temple. And I edit a magazine called Chain, and Janet Zweig is the art editor for Chain. Some of the publicity for this event said that I would be giving a talk on Janet's work, and that's not exactly true. What I'll be doing is presenting some of the things that Zweig's work makes me think about in a kind of associative accumulation. Zweig's computer sculptures call up questions about the power of machines to perform cognitive acts seemingly on their own. What those pieces say about the nature of artificial thought and its relations to human action can be applied to other kinds of machines, such as automatons, puppets, smart weapons, and poems. So I'm going to map out some of my thoughts, which will hopefully serve as a kind of resonating background when Janet describes her projects later. The title of this associative ramble is Cog Ignitions, Thinking About Objects Thinking, and it'll take about 30 minutes. Can you all see through me to the screen? Okay, good. In 1990, I saw a puppet show in the South Street Seaport in Manhattan. The puppets were very rudimentary, mostly masked actors, and their voices were projected from a small group of drummers sitting to one side. The group was Arm of the Sea Theater, and the show was about the polluting of the Hudson River. As I watched, I noticed that all the spectators, no matter what age or cultural background, were completely absorbed. They all had the look of close listening and delight. It occurred to me that puppet theater may be the most powerful form of theater there is. And so this is from the Arm of the Sea website. I just looked them up, and you get the idea. They're kind of agitprop, bread and puppet genre of puppet theater. And these are more masked actors. While the U.S. was preparing for war, there were a lot of pictures of soldiers in gas masks. This was when the justification for going in was the certainty that Saddam Hussein was hiding weapons of mass destruction. And interestingly, most images of soldiers actually in Iraq were without gas masks. I found myself drawn to these images as powerfully as I'm drawn to theatrical masks. But where in the case of the theatrical mask, I grant an object humanity, the military mask seems to ask me to grant a human object status. In an essay called Theater Circus Variety, written in 1924, Bauhaus artist Laszlo Moholy-Nagy proposes the concept of a mechanized eccentric, a completely mechanical theatrical presence that escapes the limitations of human subjectivity and the audience empathy and projection that human actors provoke. His proposal is that in the new total theater, humans and mechanical eccentrics can exist on stage equally. Humans would just be part of the theatrical organism along with props, sets, costumes, etc. The balance between human and object is what allows for a new kind of reception on the part of the viewer. Oscar Schlemmert, who ran the theater program of the Bauhaus, wrote, "A further emblem of our time is mechanization, the inexorable process which now lays claim to every sphere of life and art. Everything which can be mechanized is mechanized. The result, our recognition of that which cannot be mechanized." In the 1950s, Alan Turing, the grandfather of artificial intelligence, determined that a computer was intelligent if it could hold a conversation with a human being without being detected as inhuman. Every year, Hugh Loebner offers a prize for the first computer program that can consistently convince people that it is human. In explaining the rationale behind this prize, Loebner said, "When I was in high school, I thought that computers and robots should do all work. I was told this was impossible. To build a computer as complex as the human brain would require a computer as large as the Empire State Building, and it would require all the water of Niagara Falls to cool. Today, I remain an unrepentant utopian, I want to see total unemployment. That, for me, is the ultimate goal of AI and automation. In last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, an article called "The Unmanned Army" describes the latest developments in smart weapons and remote-controlled kills. In the future, autonomous helicopters will charge ahead of the columns, flying 15 feet off the ground at full throttle, picking off targets and ejecting micro-drones capable of close-quarter fighting. Some of these will be designed to hover within buildings, sweeping from room to room like armed dragonflies. Others will climb trees and walls like predatory orangutans. But there are other, perhaps more positively productive uses for thinking machines. Oops, I didn't want to go that far. Perhaps the best known writing device from the Ulipo group, the Workshop for Potential Literature, is Noun Plus Seven. According to this method of automatic text generation, all the nouns of a found text are looked up and it replaced with the noun that appears seven nouns later in the dictionary. An example is Leanne Brown's pledge. "I pledge allegory to the flagellant of the United Statistic of Ammunition and to the reproduction for which it stands, one naughtiness, under good, indivisible, with lick and juvenile for anatomy." The procedure frees the writer from intentionality, which in turn frees the reader from the writer's intention. Oscar Schlemmer wrote, "There is no costume which can suspend the primary limitation of the human form, the law of gravity. The endeavor to free man from his physical bondage and to heighten his freedom of movement beyond his native potential resulted in substituting for the organism the mechanical human figure, the automaton and the marionette. Possibilities are extraordinary in light of today's technological advancements, precision machinery, scientific apparatus of glass and metal, the artificial limbs developed by surgery, the fantastic costumes of the deep sea diver and the modern soldier, and so forth." Pygmalion's Galatea, Dr. Frankenstein's monster, Olympia in E.T.A. Hoffman's The Sandman, Delibes' Popelia, Hans Christian Andersen's Mechanical Bird, Kempelen, and then Maisel's Chess Player. Italo Calvino wrote, "How well would I write if I were not here?" I've been interested in poetry procedures for a long time. For example, John Cage's misostics, which are a means for writing through a source text according to a chance operation. And then I gave you on the handout a kind of fuller piece of what's on the screen. A quote or a name provides a center string, a row down the middle, as opposed to the acrostic format of a row down the left margin. And the center string determines what words will be chosen from various source texts. The first word in the poem is the first word in the source text. In this case, the source text is Finnegan's Wake. And the misostic strand, obviously, is James Joyce. Okay, so the first word in the poem is the first word in Finnegan's Wake that contains the first letter of the name, but is not followed by the second letter of the name. So what you see there is, I guess I can use this laser. So for J, what follows is the first word in Finnegan's Wake that has, it's Joe, that begins with J. So you have Joe, and Joe is okay because it doesn't include an A, which is the next letter in a string. So the second line consists of the next word found in the source text that contains the second letter of the center strand, not followed by the third, and on like that. The number of wing words appearing to either side of this chance-determined word is set according to authorial preference, and the results are rich with semantic possibility. Cage has described misostics as a way of writing that, though coming from ideas, is not about them, but produces them. The misostic procedure has been recreated by MesoList, a computer program developed by Jim Rosenberg. Is that clear how it works, the misostic? Through procedures, the reader is relieved of the usual expectations of authorial intention and is therefore permitted to read in a different, more self-directed and generative way. Certainly all readers produce meaning while reading, but the procedural poem brings that productive activity into a conscious light. Puppets make people uncomfortable. The fact that poem making can be done by a computer makes people uncomfortable. Cloning makes people uncomfortable. Artificial intelligence makes people uncomfortable. But that discomfort is also the residue of utter fascination. The idea that our own creations could have cognitive autonomy is resisted, and yet we keep striving to achieve cognitions that are separate from our own. In the case of Cage, the hope is to separate the work of art from the ego so that true discoveries can be made. But there are other, more ego-bound and power-driven reasons for attending to thinking objects, and you can find a lot of them in Hollywood. But I prefer to follow the path of John Cage rather than RoboCop at the moment. Choreographers Merce Cunningham and Bill T. Jones have been working with two computer programmers, Paul Kaiser and Shelley Eshkar, on capturing their movement. For Jones's piece, Ghost Catching, the programmers put tracers on each joint in his body and fed his movement into a computer. His movement is literally extracted from his body, and he becomes a kinetic chalk drawing. The room fills with the lines of movement, the trace of what happens there. Kaiser says, with ghost catching, we're capturing only movement, not the actual physical appearance of Bill T. Jones. There's a beauty in motion that we're sometimes distracted from seeing in dance because of the beauty, the actual physical appearance of the dancer. Poet Jackson McClough also works with procedures that have been replicated by a computer. The program Dias Text, designed by Charles Hartman, recreates the diastic form which McClough invented. An example of how diastics work can be found in the Virginia Woolf poems, and this is also a handout. The slide didn't get all of the text quite right. Here, McClough takes a phrase from Woolf's The Waves, and the phrase is ridiculous in Piccadilly. And that's the legend to spell through. The first word is the first word in The Waves that uses the letter R. The second is the next word where the second letter is I, and it goes on like that through the whole phrase, until the whole phrase has been reinvented according to letter placement. Once the entire phrase has been spelled through, the cycle repeats. McClough is much less comfortable with the term chance to describe his procedures than Cage is. Instead, McClough prefers the term non-intentionally deterministic because it acknowledges that the work is the result of authorial intention in regards to the device that generates the text and unpredictability, the results generated from the device. An article from the LA Times describes Bill T. Jones's ghost catching this way. The film begins with a single digital figure confined to an upright box, making simple, almost mechanical motions. From that figure, others emerge and are reabsorbed over and over. Quote, it's just uncanny when you see these designs moving on the screen, programmer Paul Kaiser said. Even in these abstracted bodies, you can feel intention and desire. Oscar Schlemmer wrote, everything which can be mechanized is mechanized. The result, our recognition of that which cannot be mechanized. This is a still from one of Schlemmer's dances. Perhaps the poles were a low-tech way of capturing the traces of the dancer's movement, very much in line with the goals of motion capture programming. Jones performed the ghost catching project at the Kimmel Center last year. It was his last solo performance. But he also presented it informally at Art Sanctuary the year before. At Art Sanctuary, there was a question and answer session. Many in the audience talked of dance only as a means of self-expression and transcendental inspiration. They seemed horrified at what the project represented. Jones made it very clear that he believed art to reveal mysteries that only the audience can discover. In other words, he explained the need to separate the dancer from the dance. Quote, motion capture liberates us from our usual perceptions. He clarified this for the skeptics by saying, "I want art to be as inscrutable as the Sphinx. If I make something intelligent, people will bring something to it." And this is Schlemmer again. So I'm just trying to draw some lines between 1920s kind of manual hand-drawn culture and 21st century digital culture. Whereas Cage and McClough originally devised their poem-making procedures manually and later replicated them with computer programs, other writers have used the computer as the first step in making non-intentional work. Charles Hartman and Hugh Kenner took a grammar school book called Sentences for Analysis and Parsing and ran it through two computer programs, Travesty and DiasText, which is the program made out of McClough's DiasText. At this point, the authorial trace is getting weaker and weaker, to the point where the results rely entirely on the power of words to spin signification autonomously through various combinatory configurations. It could be asked if the complexity of the procedures reap a rich enough material for the reader to work with. Meanwhile, similar experiments concerning random text generation have been cropping up all over the internet for a while now. All these works have an interest in allowing the reader to bring something to the work, of turning the reader into a writer. However, it seems to me that something is sometimes missing. Not all objects think provocatively, and not all objects provoke us to think. In his essay story on the Marionette Theater, Heinrich von Kleist examines the problem of the self-conscious dancer. The narrative proposes that the human dancer can learn a great deal from the non-cognizant object, puppets in particular. Without the ability to think, and therefore released from the gracelessness that self-consciousness inflicts, marionettes achieve a balance which emanates perfectly from their center of gravity. Thinking, or in Kleist's terms, affectation, is the downfall of grace. Kleist's essay pushes the possibility of performing objects as far as it will go, suggesting the human ideal of an entirely prosthetic man. Thus, the human will have the grace of the marionette, free of human consciousness, and in addition, free of the consciousness of the puppeteer who controls the strings. And these marionettes that I'm showing were made by Alexandra Exter probably around 1925. In 1997, Garry Kasparov lost a chess match, a thinking contest, to the IBM computer Deep Blue. Kasparov explained his loss by saying that IBM didn't give him enough information about how the computer was programmed, which is kind of interesting because it was programmed according to his own games that he had played. Previously. The newspaper editorials insisted that it was not the computer that won the match, but the minds that programmed the computer. Unlike the theater practitioners of the Bauhaus, our contemporary technoculture doesn't have any desire to see humans and objects playing equal roles on stage. Objects, to remain safe, must be subsidiary to a human thinking life. The idea that objects, and words for that matter, could have a life independent of human intention is inevitably linked to an apocalyptic worldview, the arrival of chaos. Kasparov himself called it the end of mankind, rather than as a platform for discovery and reperception. There is a story that Descartes constructed an automaton, which he called Francine, and that during a sea voyage, a fellow traveler found Francine in a case and brought her to the ship's captain. The captain thought it was the work of a sorcerer and threw her overboard. But what the Deep Blue experiment seems to have proven is that an object can indeed contain or perform a consciousness. Unlike Kleist's marionettes, Deep Blue was able to perform perfectly, with grace, while at the same time being or seeming to be conscious. The same can be said for Janet Zweig's computer sculptures. However, unlike Deep Blue, her pieces reveal the human imperfections in the artificial intelligence. The predecessor to motion capture software was a general-purpose human animation tool called Character Studio. But part of the problem with this tool was that the figures moved too well, too perfectly, and in that regard, were not truly human. As Paul Kaiser said, lost were the little accidents and secondary motions that give actual movements their individual and indeed unrepeatable character. Then the programmers got the idea that if they could sample real movement as raw data, they could solve the problem. Merce Cunningham has noted that these computerized choreographic tools open the eye to human details. Descartes believed that a machine could perfectly duplicate the lower animals. He also claimed that no machine could replicate the powers of human speech or reasoning because no machine could contain or reproduce the human soul or spirit. In order to maintain the separation between mind and matter, Descartes set out to prove that everything material, including the human body, could be understood as a mechanism. Richard Westphal describes Descartes' project this way. Determined to eliminate any mysterious entity such as life, he insisted on deriving the motion of the heart from known physical processes. In doing so, he turned the heart into a tea kettle. But what happens when the tea kettle starts to sing, when the mechanistic shows ineffable and cognizant characteristics? Much later, the rationalism of Cartesian dualism in the face of mystic chaos was looked to by linguist Ferdinand de Saussure in his work with hippograms, or anagrams. The hippogram was the term Saussure gave to the names he found to be hidden anagrammatically amongst the words of ancient Greek and Latin verse, German alliterative verse, and Vedic poetry. And this is also in the handout. I don't know how legible it is up there. His research into such hidden names was begun as an attempt to discover the origin of certain seemingly arbitrary inconsistencies within what would otherwise appear as a thoroughly systematic verse structure. Such inconsistencies might be explained away if a linguistic mechanism were discovered. Saussure needed to find that all hippograms were the result of authorial intention, that language was an ordered substance, a machine. Ultimately, after many exhaustively investigative notebooks, he failed in his quest, and the project was discontinued. Saussure's failure to determine the existence of a truly anagrammatic system leads to the uncomfortable idea of a metaphysical life of the letter, of the object of language functioning beyond human intention. In a science fiction film that might express Saussure's worst nightmare, letters take on human form and begin to make their demands. There's always a degree of intentionality, a trace of the human, in procedural poetry, the choice of source material being the most obvious. But rather than seeing the human architect of the procedure as a kind of puppet master pulling strings, I prefer to see the animate presence as simultaneous with the inanimate, just one piece of the creative organism which leads to a new kind of response on the part of the receiver. The work of procedural poets allows for the usually repressed, often disjunctive activities of language to make their appearances. As opposed to perceiving the resulting poems as opportunities for decoding, as Saussure might have done, the reader must recognize them as somewhat utopian meditations on semantic possibility. Behind the use of the procedures is the belief that if we can access the other life of language, perhaps we can find parallel methods to access similarly repressed possibilities in our immediate social context. In an email message, poet Joan Retallack wrote, "I've long had images of a dicey aesthetic nature in which I see all of civilization blowing up in the wind and then falling back to earth in scattered shards and fragments out of which one, anyone left, must compose a new mosaic culture." Of course, on a far less dramatic scale, such fragmentations of memory and object and experience are occurring all the time. The main text of Retallack's poem, After Images, appears as a split screen on the page. The top half of the screen is intuitively composed text, no chance operations, culled from Retallack's memories, collection notebooks, from ideas and associations she had while writing. The bottom screen is the residual after image, what is left after the reaction of a chance procedure has eradicated most of the composed text. And I'll try to use this later again. So what you see here is this is one of the fragments that ends up down there, the of, that. So these are just little pieces of what's above. She describes her process this way. In the After Images project, I wanted something violent as a bomb or a natural disaster or history, to happen to the text above the lines that would leave only fragments as after images below. The bombing relates to the anniversary of the first atomic detonation at Alamogordo. I literally bombarded the top half of the page with an assortment of 13 paper clips, having decided that the fragments that would remain below would be only those within the clips. Those poems have empty space after the line, that divides the page. I felt that everything that remains, partly because it would be so minimal, would, in demanding a new quality of attention to the letters, a new way of apprehending their presence in that white space, take on a strange humor and intensity. They remain for any reader, including myself, to make of them what we can. They are very suggestive to me. I delight in them much more than what is above. They are the grace, the gift of what is present, despite and beyond our control. Just going to go back to this writer. The existential computer brains of Janet Zweig's sculptures test and blur the Cartesian dichotomy. Although the thinking of the computer is obviously only programmed matter, the coincident output suggests an activity that is mental. The primary goal of 18th century automaton builders was to contest Descartes' categories to prove that objects were endowed with the capacity to think. Thus, popular automaton figures were mechanized so as to write and speak. Fortune-telling automatons functioned according to principles of coincidence, but seemed to perform thoughtful and knowing acts. Zweig herself has made a kind of fortune-telling machine with a small computer program based in grammatical rules. The computer asks the reader, "What do you want?" The reader types in an answer, money, for example. The computer is then programmed to answer something like, "Money won't be yours now, love will be yours." Even though this program is a very simple device which generates entirely random results, Zweig noticed that readers took the computer's output as truth and immediately began applying the coincidental answer to the facts of their lives. The results were seen as a product of thinking, of a knowing consciousness, rather than the random product of a machine. In other words, this program, as well as many other of Zweig's object sculptures, are based in our drive, not the machine's, to transform acts of coincidence into acts of cognition. The 18th century automatons and Zweig sculptures displayed Descartes' dualism while simultaneously contradicting it. What Zweig and the automaton makers have in common, and what Descartes and Saussure cannot share in, is a trust in chance and a pleasure in the leap of faith that exists between spectator and the kinetic performing object. Their objects prove that to make a semantic difference in the world, we ourselves must pass the Turing test and hold a lively conversation with the thoughts that our objects think. Thanks.
Good. Thank you, Jenna. That was wonderful. Just as an introduction to showing you my work, so you'll be looking at this picture for a little while, I want to talk briefly about my relationship to technology, especially because Jenna has been talking about it so much. I'm often asked to speak in technology contexts, new media discussions. I was in a show called Technophilia. I was in another show called Technoseduction. I was asked to speak on a panel called Technofetish. So I see there's some kind of pattern here. I'm glad that's not the case here. I suppose I am a technophile of sorts, but I'm much more interested in giving visual form to ideas that touch on or are about technology or media or cognitive science, especially and this fits nicely with what Jenna's just been talking about, where technology meets poetry or the emotions, or where technology runs up against some kind of unresolvable paradox. But inasmuch as I am interested in computers, I'm interested in the barest, most basic things that they can do, things that they've been able to do really from their inception, and things that fall more into the category of procedural art, the things Jenna's just been talking about, than media art. For my sculpture, I've written some small programs to generate text for my gallery sculpture. And I've been excited about what I can do with the most limited means. Most of the programs use less than 20K kilobytes. And then also by way of introduction, I just want to read this little bit by a curator named Yasha Reichart. There was an exhibit in England in 1968 curated by Yasha Reichart, and it was called Cybernetic Serendipity. It featured artists and engineers and computer scientists collaborating with each other. And I find some of this early computer work and the spirit of that collaborative venture still the most exciting. So in her catalog essay, she wrote, John Cage once advised Nam June Paik to write as much as possible before his English improved because, quote, broken English is rich in semantics. One thing that foreigners, computers, and poets have in common is that they make unexpected linguistic associations. And indeed, even with a simple scheme, even with a small and deliberately selected vocabulary, there are some poetic or grotesque associations of words which are not to be found in standard English usage. It is these gratuitous moments when a logical deterministic procedure yields a line of poetry that stimulate the imagination. So I'm going to show you some work that I've done from the 1980s that only tangentially touches on these ideas, then gallery work from the 90s, and then a little bit about what I'm doing now in public art. And these works have some things in common. I've always been interested in particular procedures. Ars combinatoria, or combinatorial arts like permutation, generative language generation or generative forms, and also recursion, looping and recursion, or what are called strange loops. And I'll explain some of these things as I go along. Since this series is called Dimensional Text, I wanted to show this book, and it also illustrates this notion of recursion. Now, recursion is a term with a lot of specificity in mathematics and computer science, but in a more generalized or literary sense, it means nested structures, things within things, for example, stories within stories. And the stories within stories told by Scheherazade, who was the fictional Persian proto-feminist of sorts, are contained or nested within the story of her own life, which is then nested within the larger narrative of what is sometimes called the Arabian Nights. So to make this book, Scheherazade, in 1988, I asked the writer Holly Anderson to write five stories, each containing the next. And I only said that they should be about women revealing or withholding information. Now, this is a flip book, and it's a little hard to show a flip book in slides, so you have to imagine that there are lots of pages between each page, and you have to imagine that it moves kind of cinematically. But as you flip the book, and the odd spelling of Scheherazade is intentional, the words come towards you so that it says she, here, she, he, she, her, she, he, etc. And as they move towards you, you start to notice that in this kind of mapscape, there is, in fact, a tiny little story emerging. And the little story grows larger, and you begin to be able to read the first story. And then that story again grows large enough to read and then moves past you, and you can read the next one. And then again, a little story comes out of that. So there's five stories within each. And then on the verso side, since flipbooks often have a left side that is blank, I thought I wanted to put something that echoed that theme. And so I put this, again, recursive image of a woman. And again, there are 32 images that repeat, but you're only going to see about 5 or 10 of them, of a woman bending down and taking off her dress, and then throwing that dress out of the book space under which is the same dress, and this keeps recurring until she takes off five dresses under five dresses. Okay. And then this dark slide connotes time passing. In 1989, I went to McDowell Colony, and the following year, I went to McDowell Colony again and met Jenna Osman. So both of those years were very important. But in that time, I realized that I had been doing very small things and very large things. I'd been doing some scenography for theater, for dance theater, and then making these very small books in large editions. And people pressed me why I hadn't made gallery sculpture. And it actually had never even occurred to me to make sculpture in the gallery, but then I just thought I would try it. So I went through a phase of making sculpture of static sculptures, and I won't show you any of those here, but I started to wonder and miss this feeling of the time-based quality of text, of the book, of the theater. So I started making sculptures that were like books really generating themselves in the gallery space. And I found that I could program computers in a really rudimentary way to do some things. One of the things I was interested in, as I said, was combinatorial or recombining texts. So this was one of the first things I did. Most of these I run on with, can we focus that or can I focus it? Let's see. That's a little better, right? This is a purely combinatorial thing without really a program. It's really run on a macro program, so it keeps combining things without a real without a program to run it. But what's happening? This piece is called The Liar Paradox or Oliver North Mobius, and what's happening is you all remember Oliver North, right? The left computer and printer is asking questions and the right is giving answers, and all of the questions and answers are excerpted from Oliver North's testimony to Congress in 1986, I think it was, and it's only the phrases that are about truth and lies. And this is a Mobius, as you know, has only one side, so it's always printing front and back. The liar paradox is a kind of circular closed thing. The simplest form of it, it's an ancient Greek paradox, the simplest form of it is I am now lying, which if you analyze it keeps going around and around. You can never kind of get out of the loop of that paradox. As it prints, and it's sometimes close together, sometimes far apart. I haven't shown this in quite a long time. This was 1991. These pieces make a lot of noise, but it does a kind of choreography of changing places, the two things, and it's moving constantly, so this is much more active than it seems. But eventually, every question falls with every answer, and they all make sense. Here are a few of them, of the many. Did you say that's not the truth? Answer, I was provided with a different version of the facts that is inconsistent with what I knew to be the truth. He said incredible things. Question, did you discuss the wisdom of putting out a false version of the facts? Answer, I did a lot of things, and I want to stand up and say that I'm proud of them. And eventually, this miraculously ran in, repeatedly in galleries for about 6 weeks at a time and never broke. And it eventually just becomes covered and covered and covered with ink until it turns completely black. I had been thinking about retiring this piece from my slide talk because it seemed, people aren't making political art anymore. And then I was reminded that, it seems actually quite pertinent these days, and I was reminded that Donald Rumsfeld says these outrageous tautologies, and I have one of them for you, just pulled this out of my computer. And I think there's a piece in here somewhere. He said, as we know, there are known knowns. I'm sorry. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know that there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know we don't know. So I think I'll revive Oliver North. after this, I made a number of pieces that were just run with things falling with each other randomly and permuting that way. But then I began to see that the computer could be a writing tool, and sort of a very rudimentary thinking device or a language generator. My programming skills are very rudimentary, but I found that if I could, you know, just do a few small things, I could really get a lot of possibilities. So I made this piece called Mind Over Matter, where I gave the computer three sentences. I gave it, "I think, therefore I am" by Descartes, "I am what I am" by Popeye, and "I think I can" by the little engine that could. And then I gave it grammatical rules and had it generate every possible grammatical sentence. And I was totally surprised to discover that the computer seemed to have a personality, and that it seemed to be talking not only about itself, but that it seemed to be filled with self-doubt. It said things like, "I think I am," or "I think I can think, I think," etc. And all of this introspection from a program that uses about 7K, so it didn't take much to fool me into thinking that I had created some kind of a golem. What happens is, as it thinks, it is able to lift the rock, which is pretty good for a computer. Okay, just a touch out of focus. Can we focus? Does this work? It seemed to work before. Oh, yes, it did. No, it was you. It was the machine, or it was Aaron. Okay, that's just a little close-up of it. Some of the pieces that I made were the output from previous procedures. And this piece, sort of the residue from procedures, this piece called Her Recursive Apology began when I noticed that a lot of young women in my classes would apologize and then apologize for apologizing, which struck me as a kind of recursive emotional gesture. So I put four little Mac SEs in my studio and four tractor feed printers, and I gave them about 50 different ways to apologize. "I'm sorry, do forgive me, I'm in error, pardon me, please forgive me, excuse me," etc. And I had them choose an apology at random, each one of the four, print it in the smallest possible type, and then repeat this. And when it ran out of paper, it would tell me on the screen how many times it had apologized. So I would come back every 4 hours or so, over a period of 2 weeks, every 4 hours, and feed it more paper and count the number of apologies. So in the end, when I'd totally run out of paper, 8,000 sheets, it had apologized 4,835,876 times. And so I've displayed it, this residue, and it is a work in progress. It could go on. It could apologize more. In a spiral, which is a recursive form, and each sheet gets larger as it goes out. And I like this contrast between the spiral and the circle, the vicious circle and the spiral, which is open. And as Vladimir Nabokov said, quote, "In the spiral form, the circle has ceased to be vicious. It has been set free." I'm especially attracted to these forms because I tend to have circular thinking. So it expresses, again, a kind of emotional parallel to this. There it is, close up. I'm deeply apologetic. This is one of those pieces that I can't really explain. It's called Solid Facts, and it's the kind of mute counterpart, the kind of embarrassingly Freudian mute counterpart to the previous one. This is a piece called Splitting the Vicious Circle, where I printed the Liar Paradox in six lines on a web press on this 200-pound roll of paper. But it repeats. It circles back to the beginning, this repeating circular argument. And then I just took this gigantic printed roll of paper, brought it into the Computer Museum in Boston, and took a handsaw and just started sawing. And it just fell like this. And then when my arm got tired, I left it, and it ended up looking like something kind of Egyptian. Um, This is another permutational language generator called Thinking Contest. I gave two computers, again, behind the wall, sort of like the Wizard of Oz. I like to keep the computers out of sight. I gave them each a vocabulary, a very large vocabulary of nouns and adjectives. They each say, I am thinking of, and then choose a random adjective and a random noun. So they, over the course of this being shown, they thought of millions and millions of things. And here are just a few of them. You know, I'm thinking of Etruscan plywood. I'm thinking of zigzag desire. I'm thinking of American Yugoslavia. I'm thinking of tax-free deceit. At any given time, one was usually winning. The big red needle gauges the contest, but it was hard to tell why. That's another little close-up. Read some of the things it was thinking at that particular moment. And this one called The Prisoner's Dilemma. This is a piece based on The Prisoner's Dilemma, which is a problem in game theory about whether it's better to cooperate with someone or betray them. It's a little bit of too long of a story to tell you in this short amount of time. But these two are linked by shared territory. Actually, they start out 25 feet apart, and they're just close together for this photograph. But they start out 25 feet apart. The paper goes in one and out the top, and in one and out the top, so that every time they print, one asks a question of the other, and the other responds by what the other has asked. So every time they respond, they pull each other a little closer, and at the end of 4 hours, they crash into each other. People have said, you know, people have really put a lot of emotional baggage on this. You know, people say, this reminds me of my marriage. This, and it hadn't crossed my mind. this is a piece at the end of this a show that I had. There was a big space in the gallery, and I was really interested in these giant offcuts from paper mills. They would cut just the edge off of the paper, and I really like these salami slices, so I took one. And it says on it, it has more or less a million thanks on it. So the idea, this was for the people who helped me with the show, you know, thanks a million, could you carry this away? And then I entered my brief mystical phase. And this is a piece I did with a painter, Laura Bergman, called Everything in the World. Some of these, I mean, especially the previous piece with the wheelbarrow, you know, there's this, and the mind over matter with the rock. I can't lift really heavy objects, and yet I make large things. So I imagine, and a lot of these people have, pieces have within them, the notion that I can lift heavy things by virtue of thinking, you know, sort of like a cartoon telekinesis. So this is, again, a 200-pound roll of paper that's being pulled by this little puny computer and little pathetic old tractor feed printer. And in this piece, Everything in the World, this 200-pound roll of paper upon which is painted a landscape after a 16th-century Dutch landscape, the computer is writing every permutation of binary code in ever-increasing places, unwinding and destroying the picture and turning analog into digital and writing the code for everything in the world. There's a close-up of the painting by Laura Bergman. And no, it does not roll back up. This is another similar piece. Before I get to that, I'll just say, in 1997, I wrote an article about historical systems that use permutation as a mystical path. I think I'm going a little too long, so I think I'm going to skip that and just get right to this. This is another collaboration with a painter, and in this case, the 200-pound roll of paper is painted as faux wood, and it is in the form of that. The title is in the form of that age-old question, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? Probably the longest sculpture title ever. This is, of course, an impossible question, based on a conditional situation, which is something familiar to computer programming. The conditional term would sort of stayed with me and turned into the would because of the woodchuck. And the answer to the impossible question had to be an unresolvable answer, and that is the number pi, or the ratio of the circumference of the circle to its diameter. Pi is an amazing number, a number with a cult following. Its decimal places are never ending, and it seems to have no pattern, it seems to never end and have no pattern. Mathematicians have now calculated it, I think, to 3.4 trillion digits, and it still seems to be entirely random. Here's the close-up of the wood. And here's the little, you know, I made a little plywood shelf, which we then painted as faux wood again, and the printer as well. At one computer symposium, the question was asked, is there a computer aesthetic? And this would have to be mine, painting the hardware to look like wood. This, I think, was the last of the tractor feed printer pieces I made and will ever make, artificial life. A little late. I'm often asked why I don't make interactive work. So I've been asked this so many times that I decided to make an interactive piece, and I made this in response to that question. So I fed a computer a variety of fortunes, which I made up, all of which comment in a self-referential way to believing in random fortunes or to the piece itself. For instance, some of them are, don't let your life be ruled by coincidence, don't take the advice of strangers, trust your animal instincts, you will be blessed with many creature comforts, don't put your faith in false prophets, etc. The printer obviously is covered in an old coat that I cut up in fur. But there is a photo release in the paw. You know, those long photo bulb releases that when you squeeze them, it makes no sense, but it's a really, really long one, and it's actually sending through the tail way far away into a little laptop. And just cranking out a random fortune. But this was, I have to say, this was a crowd pleaser at the opening, because, so it's good to make interactive things. The woman in a wheelchair got the fortune, don't put your faith in machines, and she really took it to heart. Everyone took their fortunes to heart, even though the fortunes were making fun of fortunes. They felt, and even though they knew it, they felt that the fortunes were speaking to them personally. It was scary. Even I believed it. Whenever I would get a fortune from it, I believed it. So, more time passing. The past few years I've been making public art. And I'm going to skip over something here, I think, and just go to the last two pieces that I've made. I would like to talk about... I'm sorry. I would like to talk about, very briefly, not that, but we'll just look at these people for a while. I would like to say that I made a piece at Walton High School, which I just will skip over, and then was commissioned by Fairmont Park Art Association, a member of whom is here, to make a project in collaboration with the South of South Street Neighborhood Association in Philadelphia. This project is kind of on hold, but what I have proposed is an open-air library. I mean, as you can see, I'm interested in books and text. And I would like to say that if anyone here is interested in that in any way, please come and talk to me, because it's going to be here in Philadelphia. It's still in development. And we need people to participate with it. So if you are interested in libraries, if you're interested in mobile libraries or open-air libraries or farmers markets, come talk to me afterwards. And if you live in Philadelphia, come talk to me afterwards. So I'm working on many public art projects right now, and I just am passing over that one there so I can get onto the two that seem to relate to this. See, Philadelphia. More Philadelphia. More Philadelphia. I'm sorry, I didn't take these out. Ah, okay. So I've made two new pieces this fall, and I'm going to show you this one, even though it has no either dimensional text, though it does have a random element. This was a very small commission that I made for the University of Minnesota School of Mass Communication and Journalism. I think this ties in a bit with our Oliver North and Donald Rumsfeld theme. I first made a proposal for a stairwell for them, and in the interview for this project, the dean said, "Can you make video?" And I said, "No, I can't make video." And then when I got the commission, he said, "Can you make video?" And I said, "No, I can't make video." And then after I'd made this proposal that was very much like, you know, a sort of mechanical thing like some of the things you've recently seen, he said, "Can you make video?" And and I said, "Okay, I'll make video." So I have made my one and only video piece here. And what I did was, this was a little niche in the wall. And they did a renovation, and there was a niche for garbage cans. So I just took the garbage cans out and made this into a little booth. And put this steel floor and the steel seats and then this little frame with the two lights. And what happens when two beautiful Minnesotan blondes sit there is that there's a live camera on either side and a G4 computer in the background, back behind in the closet. And they are looking at each other through the medium of live image processing. So this was really inspired by the fact that this particular school of journalism seemed very conventional. The young people who went there seemed to want to be anchor people or whatever. And they had at the end of this hall televisions on that were just tuned to CNN, MSNBC, CBS, whatever else, you know, nothing else. There didn't seem to be any questioning of that. So I wanted to, in an amusing way, remind them that of what Marshall McLuhan said in 1967, which is on the plaque. And I have that on the plaque. All media work us over completely. They are so persuasive in their personal, political, economic, aesthetic, moral, ethical, and social consequences that they leave no part of us untouched, unaffected, unaltered. The medium is the massage. Marshall McLuhan, 1967. So they seem to enjoy this enormously. What this happens is that they're talking to each other but not actually looking at each other. They're looking at each other through the medium of these flat LCD screens. And the image is constantly altering, very slowly changing. Sometimes it changes. Sometimes it's hypersaturated. Sometimes it is negative. But it's live. Sometimes it has these strange shadow effects. Sometimes you start to see yourself, so it merges it with yourself, and you see yourself for a while. This is a kind of psychedelic thing. And sometimes there's a little picture in picture where it lazily floats around the screen, and you're seeing yourself, what the other person is seeing of you. And what's really amusing about this, because we did it on a random basis, so they're each seeing different things, but on very, very once in a blue moon occasion, you get the picture in picture on both sides, and then you get an infinite regress, one of my favorite things. You get picture inside of picture inside of picture inside of picture, floating, you know, each floating around within each box. And then finally, a piece that relates more to our theme. This you'll recognize as the former sign in Penn Station, the flip signs that they no longer have of the changing letters, the flip signs that are made in Italy. So I actually researched the manufacturer of this, and because I'd always loved it, and found the manufacturer in Italy, and then I had a commission at Santa Fe Community College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for their new Instructional Technology Center, which is a computer school. So unless this piece has fallen on the floor, I can tell you this. So what I wanted to do, I proposed a sign that every time someone enters the building through the main entrance, it would trigger computer to generate a new sentence. Now, I had done very, as you know, I had done very simple language generation, but this sign had to really invent something interesting, and it needed just much more programming than I was capable of. After researching this, I soon found that you could easily get a computer to say totally nonsensical things, but it was much harder to get it to say pretty good things much of the time, and really hard to get it to say funny or amusing or interesting things much of the time. So I devised a strategy that worked. A fellow named John Meyer wrote software for me within which I programmed. So instead of making a smart bomb, I made a sort of dumb program. Instead of making a smart program that knew a lot of grammar and understood things like subject and verb agreement and things like that, I instead devised, let's see if I can go to the next slide. This is the software he designed for me. Well, it's actually just a, it's not, it's just a text program, but you'll see the software shortly. But this is the language I was programming in, so you can see it's really simple. What I did is I devised prototypical sentence structures, a lot of them, and then a huge lexicon, a huge vocabulary, so that the computer would randomly choose one of my prototypical structures, and then it would choose from for every word in that structure a different word from the lexicon, so that it was much easier. It's kind of a dumb way to do this, but it was much easier to get good sentences all the time. And then I just spent 6 months testing it and testing it and testing it. So this is one of the prototypical sentences. But this, in fact, is his software. He made this for me so that I could try one sentence. And this was one. It was the welcome to. And I usually would think of a prototypical sentence from something like this one was, welcome to the wonderful world of Disney. Sometimes the sentences would just come to my head. Sometimes I'd read a John Ashbery poem. Jenna thought of one. You know, different people would come over and think of prototypical structures, and we'd do them. So here I was testing it out early on. And what I wanted to do is have my one prototypical sentence, even though it would come up very rarely, still have so many variations that you'd rarely recognize it. So I'd give it many ways to say welcome, and in fact I added more, like step right up to, welcome aboard, etc. And even early on, you know, I would have in my lexicon I had different categories, like abstract nouns, concrete nouns, place nouns, and sort of odd categories as well. So, you know, even early on it said pretty interesting things like step right up to the abusive museum of nothing, welcome to the theoretical virus of marriage, etc. You can read some of those. Sometimes it said really insulting things, sometimes, and I also had it often speak to you, the viewer, as you were coming in, ask you questions. I wanted it to do that. Here's when I ran early on, also when I ran all of them together, just to see what would happen. And a few that I wrote were more sort of canned. Like I thought that computer students should always get a little every once in a while a sentence that asks them something about the history of computing. So this one asked me to tell you about the Turing test, which Jenna referred to. That's just one that always says, ask me to tell you about, and then it has a huge lexicon of things like the Loebner Prize and things like that. You know, also things about language, Gertrude Stein, et cetera. But some of them, some of the structures, that's the only one that's like that. Some of them you don't recognize because they'll have part of them switched, so it's, et cetera. So here it is in action. They did, in fact, make this giant flip sign for me, and it got sent from Italy, and we hung it on the soffit over this, in front of the doorway. And you can, this soffit is actually on an angle, so that when the door opens, it opens and it goes flip, 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 and you get a new sentence, but you can also see it as you're in this cyber cafe over to the right. And most of the photographs I'll show you are from there. So this is, it says, thing threatens girlfriend, a narrative of pride. And there it is, flipping, making a lot of noise, which was a bit controversial. And am I stuck? I'm stuck on the flipping. Let's see. Okay, and there's me with my mouth open because this is one of the first things it said. You will aesthetically embrace this pagan oddity. So it's alive. And I guess you can read them or I can read them to you. Was our sleep nourished by despair or delusion? Fabulous poets will sleep with you in the factories. It's like a fetish detonated by a topless commentator. This was just in the first few days when we put it up. Pardon me? Every time someone comes in the door. So it's just triggered by that and it greets you. I did put in a lot of vocabulary that had to do with computers, schools, college, stuff like that. Repression improves when there are serious professors. Kindly give the cheerleader the education, but easily. This is Jenna's structure. What if a toaster oven were to fall in love? And this is the dean who really loved it. That's his office right there. We're here to teach you how to get off easy, shall we? And what is the past, an ergonomic module? That's the end. So thank you. And if there are any questions for either of us, I guess we'll take them. You want to join me, Jenna, so I don't feel so lonely? I don't understand your question. So say it in a different way.
In Susan's first conference, you know, she had claimed to some degree that against, say, language poetry of Jackson Flynn and others, that it was precarious or dangerous to constitute an art practice that would be dependent upon contingency and
independence. I see.
Insofar as she reads into nature a more perfect disorder or order. And I was wondering if you could respond to your work in the context of that claim, that in fact nature is more contingent than a computer.
And keep going.
Well, I'm using her as the liaison.
Yeah, but can you go on with that a bit?
Sure. For instance, I found this in a slot. On the web, I've been developing a number of algorithms that randomly serve up entries from the past event calendar and archive. And I go to great lengths to kind of develop that randomness through code, despite the fact that outside of the context of technocratic modernity, it's fairly easy in nature to find random generators, fractals, and other mechanisms, and very difficult at times to make the computer produce that very same randomness.
Produce the same randomness or produce such elegant randomness?
Elegant randomness, yeah.
Produce something so interesting.
Yeah.
And tell me, no, I'm finding it really interesting, but I just want to understand what you're asking me.
Okay. There is an elaborate attempt to kind of develop a contingency or this randomness through code. And I'm not saying that is what your work is about, but I wonder if you could respond to that.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about this is that I worked really hard to make it seem not random. You know, even though it is random, I mean, I don't even think of this as random. I mean, it's really devised. But I don't fully understand your question, though I like it. That I think one of the problems with some web projects that I've seen is that they rely purely on the random, so that, you know, there's a sort of so what factor, I think, you know, that it doesn't seem to be generating something substantive. So what I try to do is generate something, and I try to really control what it is I'm generating, even though there's a sense of letting go of control. So it's a kind of fine line between that controlling something and letting the thing make something really surprising. So
that's what I was trying to point out with that census example with the Charles Hartman test, which I mean, I'm really interested in a project, but I think the results are kind of boring. Like, they're just doing the chance generation, the using the two computer programs that they use. I had the kind of so what response, so I'm trying to figure out how you get that balance between random and intentional.
Yeah, I mean, I really think of these things as quite intentional, using,
No, I agree that the conditional piece with Wood, I read this very much as a critique of, say, this hypostasization of the conditional Wood, or the if-then. But I would respond to that, in particular, side.
Yeah, I don't think I have a side exactly, but... Oh, good. That was much too hard.
This work has been that you've shown has to do with language and language in written form. Have you considered doing any work with language in speech or with speech itself?
No, I haven't. I've done some work in theater with scenography with text long ago. But you mean live performance?
Well, one of the things that occurred to me was in the printer that printed out the combination of Descartes and the mm-hmm. Cook and I forgot the other one.
Popeye.
Some of those, and I of course can't generate an example, but some of those are probably syntactically ambiguous and
right.
could be disambiguated by the use of information.
And oh, that's interesting.
Possibly that's the only way they could be disambiguated, was if something really something or someone actually said them. But that would be like a different dimension of complexity.
Yeah, you know, there's this sort of off on a tangent. There's this artist, Ben Rubin, who just did a piece at the Whitney called The Listening Post, where he has a live chat. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece, and it's I don't think it's there anymore. It's live chat coming off the web, but he has a sort of British computer voice reading it. And it's very emotional and really beautiful. But it's randomly generated, but it's coming off of live. That's the first thing that came to mind when you were asking the question, actually, to do a sort of theatrical presentation of some of these things. Yeah.
Another thing that comes to my mind is that you put these nouns in verbs and adjectives, which were in a list somewhere, and they came up randomly in the structure.
Mm-hmm.
You could sort of do that with speech sounds.
Yeah.
Like, half cat and bat. And, you could vary the...
Make a talking sign instead of a moving sign.
Sort of.
I'm very attached to making physical things in the world. So, a lot of the things I make are, in fact, I don't like to make something purely digital. There's always some mechanical aspect to it. So, when I use something purely digital, or either it goes from digital to mechanical or mechanical to digital. So I'm very attached to the stuff. But you should make something like that. It sounds really good.
Yeah, but kind of going back to the randomness, it occurs to me that I've been doing a little bit of similar kind of work, and a lot of what you see on the web and so forth, there's an underlying hypothesis that the complexity of human speech can be replicated through randomness. And I think that's a fundamental mistake, is that the richness of language is still constrained by rules. It's just that there's so much that can be said. And I very much like your approach. I mean, I'm kind of looking for a little feedback on that, that stance, but the approach in the flip side, where you had essentially, you can just add more and more sentence frames.
Right. And actually, it can get bigger and bigger and bigger.
But they're still constrained by which kind of categories of words a particular frame can select, and the
right.
more words are fine. But that's really coming very close to emulating how we actually think.
It is and it isn't. In a way, this sign can't be as inventive as people can. It can't make novel kinds of things. I mean, it makes novel combinations. Here's someone who might be able to answer that question, our resident linguist.
Well, I That piece reminds me of a grammar. In the late 1940s, my instructionist, Charles Freeze, who took letters from the War Department and cut them up into sentence frames and gave each word category a number. At the end of his book, it's a very interesting book. He actually observes that it's not recursive. And therefore, was incapable of actually exploiting human language. And he actually nested boxes. So he has this book in a bunch of nested boxes, trying to grasp what that was trying to do. Sadly, no chance to get by 3 or 4 years later. And gave us a very structured reference to Charles, the first of all. And I guess he confused. But yeah, I mean, the more information you give to something, the richer it becomes. So one of the current projects is a thing called WordNet, which sort of takes words and finds all the associated words in place of a dictionary. So you get a huge semantic network.
Yes, in regard to that, yours is syntactically constrained, but not semantically constrained.
Right, exactly.
That's where the oddities come from.
That's where the oddities come from.
But if you could make something that were semantically constrained, of course, if it weren't semantically constrained, you couldn't make any sense out of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting way to put it. Questions for Jenna? Thank you very much.